So good evening, everyone. Good to see you all. This is the final night, the final installment of the series we've been doing called Practices for Nurturing Connection. Don't worry if this is your first one or if you've missed any. It's not designed, it's designed so that you can come as you're able, but the others are, we are posting them on the website in case you want to catch up. And a couple of people have asked for asked for the discussion questions and the kind of take-home practices, and so I'm going to add them as well. We started the first night with gratitude, and then we talked about trust, generosity, empathy, and integrity. And for those of you who have been to at least one, or at least two, you've probably seen how they interrelate and support each other, these practices, these qualities that we can cultivate. So I thought I would conclude with forgiveness, because without the practice of forgiveness, we just wouldn't get far with any of the others. Last week we talked about integrity, not as a narrow adherence to a set of rigid standards, but as a spacious and deep understanding of our essential interconnectedness with others, from which we can speak and act in alignment with our highest values. And we recognized last week that we blow it again and again. We fall short of our highest aspirations. We have generations of conditioning behind us, not just this particular life we're in, but generations of conditioning that come to us in our history and our culture. So of course we're going to slip and backslide and fail again and again. And it's our practice of paying attention to body and mind and our insight into our true nature that are what helps us to detox the kind of... We talked about the three poisons of greed, hatred, and ignorance. And these are our karmic inheritance as human beings, right? But our practice of mindfulness, of paying attention, and our insight are what helps to detox those poisons. Dogen Zenji, who founded the Soto Zen school in Japan, is quoted as saying, "A Zen master's life is one continuous mistake." I looked at the Japanese and I realized that I think it's actually better translated, "A Zen master's life is one mistake after another." Do you ever feel like that? You know, those days where you cannot do anything right? Or those days when somebody else who is getting on your nerves can't do anything right? You know, there are days like that. That's why we need to practice forgiveness of ourselves and of others, to be able to live in this world of human imperfection without driving ourselves mad. Holding on to grudges and grievances is one of the most painful kinds of self-clinging. Right? You know, there's nothing, you know, that kind of eats away at us quite like holding on to a grudge. It's like a nasty abscess inside. So hard to let go of. And sometimes it's hardest to let go of self-recrimination, to forgive ourselves. Sometimes we're more forgiving of others than we are of ourselves. In my years of doing hospice work, I often heard stories of individuals who needed to forgive or be forgiven before they died, and sometimes some who were unable to. I remember in particular a man who was he was pretty mean and obnoxious to the volunteers and the nurses. He was not an easy patient. He'd led a somewhat rough life, and he had a son who would not come to see him. The son's girlfriend came to see him, and she was really the only person that this man was pleasant to. And she finally persuaded the son to come. The man's wife had died when the boy was early adolescence, maybe 13 or 14, and the dad had turned to drinking a lot, and the son remained really angry at him for not being there for him. So the son finally came, and I'm not sure who reported this story, a nurse or a volunteer, but they had a very brief conversation, and the father said, "I did the best I could." That was it. That was his apology. And yet he clearly needed to say it. He needed to say it. Because after that point, he was like a different person. He was pleasant. He was calm. And he died a day or two later. There's a film about forgiveness, a documentary film. It's quite good, and maybe we'll show it sometime, by a filmmaker named Helen Whitney. And she consulted closely with Monsignor Lorenzo Albacete of New York City. And I really like this quote that she included from him. He says, "The hunger for connection and the terror of going into the night unconnected, unreconciled, is that fundamental. Forgiveness is a primordial ache in the human heart that precedes all religions. It precedes everything. No matter what the theologians and the religious folks will tell you, religion arrives late on the scene. We provide, at best, structures for this existential ache." I think he's suggesting that our need for forgiveness goes back to the birth of human self-consciousness, both in terms of our evolution as a species and our development as individuals, when we are dawning awareness that we are separate from our mother and father, you know, that we are a person. Our human urges to aggressive behavior have been much studied and are widely believed to be hardwired in us. Certainly, our fight, flight, or freeze response has been necessary to our survival. But less appreciated and less studied is the nurturing and caring response to others that is also equally essential to our survival as social animals, right? We have hormones that tune our bodies to fight or flee, and we have other hormones that tune our bodies to give and receive soothing and nurturing. We have the capacity to break relationships and to mend them. Highly social apes, like gorillas and chimpanzees, have been observed using mutual grooming. You've all seen them, kind of, you know. To reestablish goodwill and trust after a conflict. I think of it as a kind of proto-forgiveness ritual. So we've had some 500,000 years of evolution as Homo sapiens, and we're still working on it. How do we mend relationships? It's been said that to err is human, to forgive divine. But perhaps our task is to make forgiveness more human, to make it more ordinary without cheapening it, without making it into a daytime TV commodity. So what is it? What is forgiveness? How do we do it? Before we talk about forgiveness, and I want to talk about it from a Buddhist perspective as well, let's look at what it isn't. Let's look at some of the myths about forgiveness that can get in our way. So first, forgiveness isn't weak or naive or soft. Those who forgive are not wimps. It takes courage and the hard work of self-examination. Forgiveness does not justify or condone or excuse harmful actions. It doesn't let the offender and offender off the hook of responsibility. It doesn't minimize or deny harm done, saying, oh, that's all right, it doesn't matter. No. It does matter. Harm has been done. So we need to, forgiveness doesn't gloss over. But it's also not a simple, quick fix. And it's not once and for all. Have you ever felt like you've forgiven and then had all that hurt just come welling up again? You know? It's a process, and it can take years, slowly deepening. It can take a lifetime. And it's not a matter of forgetting. You know, forgive and forget? I don't think so. Maybe that means forget your grudge. Let go of your grudge. But it's not a matter of forgetting what happened. We can remember what happened, but without the bitterness, without the resentment, with a clear seeing of the roots of human suffering, and with compassion. So it is possible to forgive and remember. And forgiveness may or may not lead to reconciliation, or reestablishing a relationship. It's not necessarily a wholesome thing to reestablish a relationship that's very, very harmful. It only takes one person to forgive, but it takes two to reconcile. You can forgive to release your own heart, to open your own heart. One more myth about forgiveness is that in our closest relationships, there should be no need for apology or forgiveness. Have you ever heard the old platitude, love means never having to say you're sorry? Have you ever heard that? Maybe it's outdated. Used to hear it. Well, in fact, it's often harder to forgive those closest to us than to forgive strangers, because we feel more deeply betrayed when those who are close to us hurt us, right? Or lie to us or abandon us. And forgiveness does not depend on apology or remorse of the offender, the person we feel harmed us. As I said, it's not, it's primarily the work of our own heart to forgive, the opening of our own heart. Apology and remorse on the part of the offender might help open our heart to forgive, but it's not dependent on that. It's not contingent on that. So those are all things that it is, that forgiveness isn't. What is it? Most simply put, I would say it's being able to open your heart to those who have done harm. The Catholic writer Henry Nouwen says, forgiveness is the name of love practiced among people who love poorly. And by poorly, he means imperfectly. So that means all of us. Who here can claim to love perfectly? Mm-hmm. So forgiveness is the name of love practiced among people who love poorly. The hard truth is that all of us love poorly. We need to forgive and be forgiven every day, every hour, unceasingly. That is the work of love among the fellowship of the weak that is the human family. So here's my working definition. This is something that I've kind of been practicing with a long time. My working definition: forgiveness is a process of healing and purifying the heart by releasing bitterness, pain, and holding towards those whom we feel have harmed us, or who harmed us, or it's not necessarily even it could be harmed someone or thing that is dear to us, that we identify strongly with. And we do that by acknowledging our own pain, by feeling it, grieving our losses, and then by making a choice about how we want to live with the reality of harm in human life. Harm, we could say evil if we find that word useful, or imperfection, you know, our flawed humanity, or our ignorant humanity. So here's where the Buddhist perspective comes in for me. We also do this by simply seeing deeply into the ancient tangled roots of human greed, hatred, and ignorance. You know, our karmic lives as human beings, seeing deeply, deeply into that, and through doing so, opening our hearts to compassion. We see in ourselves and in those who do harm to us and others, those who do harm, we see our common ground in that human yearning to be happy, to be free of suffering. So even those who do harm yearn to be free from suffering. They are suffering. And from that suffering, they do harm. Stanford University has a forgiveness project, and the director of that project, Fred Luskin, did a workshop up here in Vancouver some years back. And he talked about some of the powerful work he's done in communities such as in Northern Ireland and in the Middle East, where cycles of vengeance and retribution go back generations. Some very moving work. And he offers some helpful models. So I want to share just one part of that work with you. He identifies the components of a grievance. Okay, so the first component of a grievance is taking something too personally. Right, our practice tells us, or supports us, to look into the self, you know, and how we attach to our ideas about ourselves. So taking something too personally. Second is blaming the offender for how you feel. And third is creating a story of grievance that reflects helplessness. You know, that we are the victims of that person's behavior. It's very convincing. Very, very convincing story, right? Especially if somebody's really hurt you. But all those components derive from our self-focus, our self-clinging, seeing ourselves as the center, pitted against our whoever, our enemies, or those who are out to get us. And this is always, always guaranteed to be a partial view of the large picture. And it's a conditioned view. It's conditioned by our, you know, the many, many things that condition our lives. And it's always partial. So in contrast to that, the components of forgiveness are correspondingly viewing the offense less personally, so opening up a more spacious view of the causes and conditions that led to that offense or event. Second, taking responsibility for your own emotional experience, and thus also for your speech and actions in response. So that's one thing we can have some agency, some control. We can choose our response. We can bring awareness to our emotional experience. And three, changing the story. Changing that narrative to reflect a choice to be free from anger and resentment and bitterness, to grow and thrive. Now you might say, oh yeah, fine for him to say, but, you know, that thing that happened to me that was really bad. And I was really, really, really hurt. And that person was really, really wrong. When things don't go the way we want, we suffer. Those are the first and second noble truths taught by the Buddha, right? There is suffering in human life, and it is caused by, we suffer by our desire for things to be other than they are, for life to be different from the way it is. We create what Fred Luskin, the Stanford Forgiveness Project director, calls unenforceable rules about the way life should be for us. So here's an example. People should not lie to me. Most often these unenforceable rules utilize the word should. If I work hard and I'm a good person, bad things won't happen to me. Right? Can you think of any others? Unenforceables? People should be considerate, shouldn't they? And we can even make these unenforceable rules retroactive. My parents should have treated me better. Right? Can we make any of these things happen? Are these under our control? Can we enforce these rules? No. And yet we torment ourselves and others by trying to enforce them. She should have known that I was tired and not feeling well. When we practice forgiveness, our state of open-heartedness will fluctuate. At times, we may only be open to the distant possibility of forgiveness. And so our hearts may open, and then they might close again. You know, so we have to be patient with ourselves as we do, as we practice in this territory, and not make forgiveness itself into a should, a rule. Can't be forced. We can cultivate the ground and we can nurture the plant, but we can't make it grow and flower. At its most basic, forgiveness is the way we bring ourselves back to awareness when we forget to pay attention to our lives. Our Zazen practice is a practice of continually remembering to pay attention, and then we forget, right? We forget and we forgive ourselves, we notice, and then we forgive ourselves and patiently come back to awareness of breath and body, perceptions, emotions, and thoughts. So instead of forgive and forget, we forget and forgive. Forget and forgive. Forget, remember to pay attention, and forgive. Buddhist Vipassana teacher Sharon Salzberg, who has taught this practice a lot, says, to be able to forgive is so deep a letting go that it is a type of dying. We must be able to say, I am not that person anymore, and you are not that person anymore. There's a wonderful story. This is in a book by Jack Kornfield, an American Vipassana teacher. I think I'll take a few minutes to read it to you. It's about that I'm not, you're not that person anymore. Once on a train from Washington to Philadelphia, I found myself seated next to an African-American man who had worked for the State Department in India but had quit to run a rehabilitation program for juvenile offenders in the District of Columbia. Most of the youths he worked with were gang members who had committed homicide. One 14-year-old boy in his program had shot and killed an innocent teenager to prove himself to his gang. At the trial, the victim's mother sat impassively silent until the end, when the youth was convicted of the killing. After the verdict was announced, she stood up and stared directly at him and stated, "I'm going to kill you." Then the youth was taken away to serve several years in the juvenile facility. After the first half year, the mother of the slain child went to visit his killer. He had been living on the streets before the killing, and she was the only visitor he'd had. For a time, they talked, and when she left, she gave him some money for cigarettes. Then she started step by step to visit him more regularly, bringing food and small gifts. Near the end of his 3-year sentence, she asked him what he would be doing when he got out. He was confused and very uncertain, so she offered to set him up with a job at a friend's company. Then she inquired about where he would live, and since he had no family to return to, she offered him temporary use of the spare room in her home. For 8 months, he lived there, ate her food, and worked at the job. Then one evening, she called him into the living room to talk. She sat down opposite him and waited. Then she started. "Do you remember in the courtroom when I said I was going to kill you?" "I sure do," he replied. "Well, I did," she went on. "I did not want the boy who could kill my son for no reason to remain alive on this earth. I wanted him to die. That's why I started to visit you and bring you things. That's why I got you the job and let you live here in my house. That's how I set about changing you. And that old boy, he's gone. So now I want to ask you, since my son is gone and that killer is gone, if you'll stay here. I've got room, and I'd like to adopt you if you'd let me." And she became the mother of her son's killer, the mother he never had. Traditionally, forgiveness is practiced in preparation for a meditation called metta, or loving-kindness practice. Because it's pretty hard to extend loving-kindness and compassion if you're holding on to grudges. And the phrases that are used, it takes more time than we have tonight to do this practice, but the phrases that one uses for this meditation are first to ask forgiveness for harm that we've done. So it goes, "There are many ways I have harmed others, intentionally or unintentionally, through my speech, thoughts, or actions. I now ask for forgiveness." Or sometimes it helps to say, "I open my heart to receive forgiveness." And then you extend forgiveness to others using that same sequence, or you can simplify it. And then the last step is extending forgiveness to yourself. So this is an actual meditation practice using those phrases. And then moving on to practicing loving kindness, extending loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, and joy. I'll put some text for a forgiveness meditation on the website for anybody who's interested in working with that on your own a bit. And Sharon Salzberg's books are a wonderful resource for that. But I also want to encourage you to practice mini forgiveness. You know, with all the small ways that things don't go the way we want. With each moment of awareness, with each breath, we have the opportunity to release some of our holding on to past grievances. Jack Kornfield once quipped, "Forgiveness is giving up all hope of a better past." But I would actually counter that and say forgiveness actually changes our past. And because of the way we view it differently, it rewrites that story of victimhood or helplessness and into a story of courage and healing and open-heartedness. This practice takes great patience, but over time we can feel how it allows room in our hearts for kindness and compassion to grow and to extend in ways that we might never have imagined. So I'm going to stop there.